Hello and welcome to the October edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynemouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor.
And I'm Valerie Forrester. It's the 8th anniversary of our talking newspaper's edition of Roundabout this month, and I take this opportunity to thank you for your continued support of our talking newspaper. And thanks also go to our volunteer teams who have recorded the weekly news and monthly magazine to date.
Here is what we have in store for you this month. Jenny Jenkins interviews Mr. Stacey Gilbert. This will be followed by Stacey's choice of music. Valerie will be reading an article from the Exminster newsletter about an ancient ship.
Norma Orty from the Blue Team is making her debut in Roundabout and will be reading one of her stories entitled The Green Man.
Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald will be reviewing this month's book entitled The Grand Tour by Ben Aitken.
And Aileen Clarkson will be sharing her letter from a dog walker.
Fran Frank will be reading an article about plastic houses.
John Townsend will be explaining why he hates Halloween. And this will be followed by our concluding song.
We begin with the Jennifer Meets interview.
Hello, dear listener. Today for my interview for Jennifer Meets, I've been very curious to know how my guest came to have a shop here in Tynemouth. So welcome to our roundabout, Stacey Gilbert.
Good afternoon, Jennifer. How you doing?
I'm fine, and it's lovely to meet you, and many people will probably recognise you from your very distinctive shop in Bank Street called The Refill and Deli. And I'd like to start with your beginning, which is a very good place to start. Where were you born, and tell me a little about your parents?
So I was born in Lewisham in South London. Parents and all of my family were from the East End of London, in and around the sort of Blackwall Tunnel area and then up to Islington. So they met and lived in South London near Broccoli, and I was born in Lewisham.
Well, touch my finger, because that's where I was born as well.
It's a remarkable coincidence.
We have a few, haven't we?
We have.
And when were you born?
1973, January 1973.
That's good. And I believe your mum and dad had a grocery shop in...
Yes.
Is that right?
Indeed. A small family business back then, and lived in there till mid-70s, 1975.
I believe there was some family skills in the fact that curing smoked fish was one of their specialities.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly.
And did you pick that up as well, skills?
Yes, so I can remember, earliest memories of going to the shop, and then my father was involved in a business, smoked salmon business in the East End of London, mm-hmm. just off the Mile End Road, and I've very early memories of the smell of smoked fish in the air.
Did it put you off eating it?
No, at all. Loved it.
No,
absolutely
I love
loved
it too.
It. Yeah.
My dad used to love going there to the up the East End to get.
Yeah.
It wasn't jellied eels; it was stewed eels.
Wow.
He loved. Loved it.
I'm not sure I'd like them as much.
He said it's a cross between chicken and something else.
Yeah.
But anyway, I believe you moved down to Tunbridge Wells, which is what we did as well.
Yeah.
And a school I know very well, which is Tunbridge School, is where you attended.
That's right, yeah. So a bit later on, yes, so my parents thought that maybe the East End of London wasn't the best place to bring up children, so they went over the hill and down the A21 and ended up in Kent, you're quite right. Yeah, from the age of 13 to 18 I was at Tunbridge School, very lucky.
Oh, it's a very good school.
Incredible school.
What were your main interests at Tunbridge School?
Played a lot of sport, very into sport. Obviously, 6 days a week we were playing some form of sport. But then academically, really enjoyed politics, economics, mm-hmm. History, geography, which I went on to do politics at university. So that sort of lit my fire.
You managed to get into Bristol University, well done. I believe you did something before you actually started there. So tell me about that.
I went on a gap year, so I did some travelling in between school and university.
Where did you go?
So, started off in South Africa, beautiful country, but back in the time of the democratic election, so it was parts of it were a bit more exciting than others.
I think you also followed me to Zimbabwe.
Indeed I did, yes, no, quite right.
Strange,
I managed to get out of South Africa and And then, yes, quite right, in the back of a pickup truck, went around Zimbabwe and saw some
beautiful
things, beautiful people, beautiful countryside.
Well, moving on from the freedom, after that, I believe you were a factory manager for a few years, but you didn't like it, so we'll skip over that.
Yeah, that's right.
Living in Docklands, back to London.
Yeah, back to the East End.
And started your new company. What was that called?
So back in 1996, we started a company called The Galloping Chef, which was me, my sister and my parents. And originally we were supplying wholesalers, did a lot of farmers markets back in the day, producing sort of pies and pastries and cakes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And travelled all around the southeast of England, sort of selling our wares, which was good.
Well, somewhere along the way, you met and married your wife, Tracy.
That's right, yeah.
And then you had your family of
four children. One stepson, Tom, right. Two boys, Harry and Joe, and Amelie, little girl, left on the end.
Wonderful. And then you found somewhere splendid to live in Long Milford.
Long Milford, that's right.
Melford.
Long Melford.
North Elford. Well, tell me about this and what did that lead to?
So we went up to Suffolk for a weekend and stayed in a lovely bed and breakfast, which turned into the house that we bought. We were chatting to them over breakfast and they said that they were selling the house. So we
thought this would be
amazing if we bought it. We did that. We're there for 16 years.
Goodness. The idea was originally for a bed and breakfast, wasn't
it? Yes, so we were sort of thinking about something that my lovely wife could do while bringing up the children. Mm-hmm. So running a bed and breakfast sort of fitted in quite well with that, and sort of dropping the school kids off at school and then looking after guests.
And you were still running the business?
We moved the business up to Suffolk at the same time.
Suffolk.
So, yeah, exactly right.
So your last child, Amelie,
yeah.
Pretty name, was born. And what did you decide to do then?
So we were at that time fostering. So, again, we were sort of thinking, my wife, her side of the family, has some adoption within the family. So it was something that she wanted to do. Mm. Sounds a bit cliche, but to sort of give back to the system. So we did that for 12 years.
Now you've already got your own children.
Yeah.
And how many children did you foster? How many at a time?
Well, the most in the household at any one time. We had 9 children at one stage, I think was the record. So that was a bus full of children moving around.
I can imagine.
In various different activities and schools and whatever. So that was a busy time, but good fun. The children, actually, to be fair, all the way through, there was obviously some challenges, but actually overall the children, including our children, got on really well and I think enjoyed themselves.
What age groups were they?
So we did, originally we were similar children's ages to our own, so we were boys and girls.
Good.
But then as we got further into it, probably the last 4 or 5 years, we sort of specialised in teenage girls. So we had quite a few teenage girls.
Wonderful,
coming through
and
the
in
house.
The perfect house for it.
Yes.
The
building. Yeah, no, exactly right. Exactly right.
And I've got here the total of number of children you fostered was the grand total of about 30.
About 30 in total, I think. Yeah, about that.
Amazing.
Over the period.
So. I mean, you just look the part to me.
I'm not
you
sure
look
about
really
that.
An all round bloke who
no,
could.
I'm not sure. No, I
well, you enjoyed that.
Wife needs to take most of the credit. I think she was at the sharp end of it.
Takes two to tango.
Well, absolutely. But I was clearing up afterwards. That was the.
Well, your family are now all grown up, and your mum and dad retired to look after their grandchildren. I'm reading from my notes here because I have to write things down. Hopefully, I haven't made too many mistakes.
No,
but,
spot on.
2013, your sister and 3 children moved back to Kent.
Yep.
So you were on your own in the business
That's
then?
Right. Yeah.
Right. And I've just got here, you fancied a change of scene. Tell me more.
Exactly right. So we had a natural break with the children's ages that Harry was about to start A-levels, Joe was about to start GCSEs, and Emily was still at primary school. So we'd done 15, 16 years in Suffolk. And as lovely as Suffolk is, and I would definitely carry on living there. However, we fancied a bit of seaside. Mm-hmm. And originally we're looking in the Dorset area, sort of Lyme Regis and around there, because we wanted to sort of be 4 hours or so from Suffolk, so we can keep going back. However, Dartmouth came up on the and we thought, well, actually, maybe we can look slightly further down the coast, because it actually gets prettier and prettier.
Yeah.
And exactly that. So we came down here 7 years ago.
Oh, well.
So and never looked back.
Put your roots down.
Exactly right.
And so you then had a business.
Still the business in Dartmouth. Yeah, still the business in Suffolk.
So
we were commuting back every week. So one of us would go back every week to sort of manage
quite
the business.
Hike. But you started another business in Totnes, I believe.
Here. Yes, so about 5 years ago, we opened up a shop in Totnes on the side of Annie's Fruit Shop, which was selling refill and loose goods and a lot of the goods we made ourselves. We sort of trialled it to see how we would, we got on and did really well, and it's still there. So
how did you come to Tynmouth?
So finally how to Tynmouth then was...
This is like joining the dots.
It is exactly that. So with all the challenges that COVID brought, one of the positives out of it was I didn't have to go to Suffolk every week. So there's a young lad who's worked for me since he was 14 who manages it for me. He's now in his 30s, but he didn't need me to go up to Suffolk every week. So it didn't need two of us in one shop down here. So we said, well, if we had a shop each, that would be good. So we looked around, came to Tynmouth, I stopped counting at 50 independent shops in Tynmouth when I looked around the town. So I thought, well, there must be a reason why there's 50 independent shops here. So we opened up a shop here 3 years ago.
This isn't your original one, though. You were in a different premises, and then
we were originally next door in the old YMCA shop. That was the only one that was free. And then one day, a lovely chap came in and said, "Oh, I'm buying next door.
Oh,
it's the old co-op or building society.
Building society,
yeah,
yes.
Shop which has been empty for a long time. Anyway, he was buying it." And would we be interested in moving into it if he did it up?
And that's the way the cookie crumbled.
And that's the way the cookie crumbled. So I end up with a slightly nicer view looking down the corner.
Yeah, perfect.
And then for the first time in a long time, the shop has been full. And then, as it turns out, by a twist of fate, it previously used to be a grocer back in the day. Well, there's two different families who owned it and ran its grocers before.
Well, it's good to look into the history of all our buildings. They've got so much.
As lovely as all the people in Tynmouth are, there's some really interesting people who know the history and have come in and told me and listed it all out and showed me photos and stuff.
Have you met Viv Wilson, our local historian?
I have, yes.
She's a font of all knowledge.
And I've met the granddaughter of the original owner as well.
As well?
Yes.
That's lovely.
So, yeah, that's lovely. The May family and the Stent family, I think, are the two families that used to own it.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's amazing how it full circle comes round. So,
I've got one last question before we have to finally wind up. I know you do the cooking because I can smell it when I come into the shop and you're out the back beavering away, all homemade stuff. Who does the cooking at home?
me as well. I it's one of the things I love doing. So
that's good.
It's not a chore.
So Tracy's a lucky girl.
Well, sometimes if I'm on good form. Sometimes it's only eggs on toast. So I'm not too excited.
Well, before we have to wind up completely, I like to say our thank you by saying, would you like to choose a piece of music and why you've chosen it to play us out of our conversation?
Excellent. So I've chosen Lippy Kids by Elbow, and the simple reason is it just always reminds me of the things that make me smile.
A lovely choice. I bet you had a few Lippy Kids in your 30.
It reminds me of those as well, yeah.
Yes, as well. Well, thank you for being our guest today, and all we can say is to our lovely listener, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
Coming along. Thank you.
kids on the corner again. Blippi kids on the corner begin saddling like crows. Though I never perfected the simian stroll, cigarettes and it was everything then. Do they know those days are golden? Build a rocket, boys. Build a rocket, boys. Down from the trees and curbstone cool, you were a freshly painted angel walking on walls, stealing booze and our long hungry kisses. Nobody knew me at home anymore. Build a rocket, boys. Build a rocket, boys. Build a rocket, boys. Blippi kids on the corner again. Kids on the corner begin settling like crows. And I never affected that simian stroll. Golden, build a rocket, boys. Build a rocket, boys. One long tune, I came down from the trees and curbstone cool, you were a freshly painted angel walking on walls, stealing booze and our long hungry kisses. Nobody knows me at home anymore. Build a rocket, boy.
That song was Lippy Kids by the band Elbow. Valerie, you're on next with an article.
This is an interesting article by Graham Toombs from the Axminster Local History Society. There seems to have been a yet unexplained major disaster in the eastern end of the Mediterranean around 1000 BC, which caused a huge fall in the population. Then, quite recently, a local diver discovered a sunken merchant ship, the Uluburun shipwreck, off the Turkish coast, from which a lot was learned about trade before this disaster. Archaeologists between 1984 and 1994 dated the vessel from about 1300 BC. The ship was built from oak and cedar woods thought to be from Lebanon. It is thought that the vessel was sailing from possibly Palestine or Cyprus and headed for either Rhodes or the Hittite Empire. Its cargo demonstrates the extent of trade at the time. There were copper ingots from mines in Cyprus, and also tin ingots destined presumably to make bronze weapons, armour and tools. There was enough copper and tin to make 11 tons of bronze. There were sacks of coloured glass, musical instruments, dye, olives and beads from Canaan, blackwood from Africa, Egyptian gold jewellery, hippopotamus teeth, elephant tusks, ostrich eggshells and turtle shells. There were weapons thought to come from as far apart as the Alps, Italy, Bulgaria, Greece and Palestine. There was amber thought to be from the Baltic and a range of foods, a seal of Egyptian Queen Nefertiti and boxwood writing books. This was a remarkable find and insight into Bronze Age life and trade. It was one of the oldest ships ever discovered and contained the wealthiest and largest cargo of late Bronze Age items ever found in the Mediterranean.
Listener, our next contributor is Norma Orty. You may recognise her voice from the Blue Team's weekly news. Norma joined Here and Now earlier this year and has lived in Dawlish since 2015. Prior to that, she and her husband lived in South Africa for over 40 years. She has written numerous stories over the years, many with South African themes, and she will be sharing them in the forthcoming roundabout programmes. Here is the first of her stories.
The Green Man. Tom glanced behind and saw that the man appeared to be following him. He had been in the Green Man, a country pub where Tom had eaten a late dinner. The man had been seated in a dark corner, and Tom had noticed him when his attractive dinner companion had complained loudly that they would be late and had flounced from the restaurant. Tom had leisurely finished his brie and a glass of Beaujolais, caught the eye of the yawning waiter, and paid his bill. He collected his scarf and coat and left. As he felt the outside temperature, Tom shivered. It was very cold and foggy for late October. He buttoned his coat and set off at a brisk pace down the deserted lane. The fog was quite thick, and in the still air he heard footsteps echoing his own, and he thought that the man was following him, about 20 meters behind. Tom's breathing increased as he quickened his pace, and the man did too. At last they neared the edge of town, and Tom was aware of shadowy figures emerging from the side streets, alleys, and doorways. They were all heading in the same direction. Feeling that there was safety in numbers, Tom followed the gathering crowd. Daring to look behind, Tom had a view of his pursuer. Now, not as threatening as he greeted the girl from the pub. They seemed pleased to be reunited. And now, looking boldly, Tom saw that they and all around them were weirdly dressed, some as devils, others as clowns or gypsies. The man was the Green Man, and the girl was a fairy. Of course, Tom realized that it was October the 31st, All Hallows' Eve, or Halloween, now so popular, and he was the odd man out, in his workaday clothes. Soon he was subjected to the unwelcome begging of trick-and-treaters, who surrounded him demanding their dues. Several looked quite menacing, and Tom decided time had come to play his trump card. He slowly unwound his woolen scarf and revealed his clerical collar. Immediately the mood changed, and with calls of, "Evening, Vicar," the crowd turned towards the centre of town, and Tom turned to his vicarage next to the church. Time to turn in. A busy day tomorrow.
Well, Halloween will be with us soon, so that was a gentle reminder about it from Norma. John Townsend will be on later with more about Halloween. We now have Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald discussing the book The Grand Tour by Ben Atkin. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook.
Well, hello. This month, Mary and I have been reading a travel book, but rather an unusual travel book. It's called The Grand Tour. Not The Grand Tour, but The Grand Tour. And it's subtitled Travels with My Elders. And it's by a writer in his 30s, a London-based writer called Ben Atkin, who had the idea about 2016, 2017, it's around that time, of going on a series of coach holidays, short coach holidays. They're called Shearings, I think, the company.
It's very popular.
And basically he's half the age, if not more than half the age, of all the other people on the bus. And it's just a gentle, charming, rather sweet story of the people he met, the conversations he had, the places he went to. It's quite funny. And I just thought I would recommend this as being just a nice, relaxing read.
And that from a young man. Personally, speaking from my end of the age scale, I remember when I was middle 30s to 40s, friends and I joined a coach trip, and our horror when we got on, they're all grey. Now we are of that happy group. But then it's lovely. And of course, I found so many things familiar from current travels and short trips, which I still do with much pleasure. But the all other insight as well is the thinking. It's a very c'est la vie with the travellers, and today is the day to enjoy, never mind what's happened before, and the sadness is there. Obviously there are widows and widowers, and it's looking back and looking forward. It's just fun, and I have to report that my friend commented on the fact that I was laughing at night keeping her awake because it was so funny.
Yeah, it's a very simple little book really, because he goes mainly in this country. He does do one little trip to Ireland and one lovely one to Italy and Switzerland, yes, which is kind of the highlight of the book in many ways from a travel point of view. But it's all really about the people he meets, people he sits next to on the bus, people he sits next to at breakfast, plays bingo with, this sort of thing, and the conversations that they have. And as you say, some of it's got a certain sweet sadness about it, I would say, because a lot of them are on their own dealing with loneliness. Maybe some of them gone on the trips because they've been recently widowed.
Absolutely.
Some of them have disabilities. There's this wonderful character, he has to have drops put in his eye.
Yes.
Very old, very posh. Used to work at GCHQ in Cheltenham. He's just such a character. And it's full. It just teems with these dozens and dozens of characters. And they all say funny things. They don't really care about what anybody thinks about them anymore.
Why should they?
And it's just a rich vein for a lovely, is. Gentle comedy.
And one of the things you're saying about people he sits by, actually he doesn't. He sits in his single seat and various travellers come and sit by him and engage him in various conversations or not. They just talk, which is a quite common thing, actually. They just talk and he just makes comments here and there, and the next day it could be somebody completely different. But they all the travellers seem to want to spend some time with him, whichever country they go to, whichever town or city, seaside, whatever. They want to share things with him. And one of the interesting things is, on one of the trips he took his own girlfriend, and on another trip he took his own nan. And there again, lots of interaction and comment from the other travellers about that circumstance.
And he's very respectful. This isn't at all a young person laughing at older people.
Not at all,
he's very respectful, and he listens sensibly to them. He's very interested in what they've got to say. There's a lovely little section in where he talks about the wisdom of age, right at the end, the last paragraph of the book, where he sort of sums up what different thinkers over the years have said about wisdom and what he's learned from doing these six trips. I think they're really back-to-back. Very little gap in between, so he's basically...
Well, he actually got into one coach station and got on the next coach.
Yeah, the next one
immediately. And as you say about the wisdom, it is, as he goes through, he gains wisdom and insight himself and takes a completely different perspective of his fellow travellers.
I listened to the audio, which is him reading it himself.
Oh, that's
very
excellent.
Charming. He's not terribly good at regional accents, so if you do listen to the recording, you know, you will get some rather peculiar attempts at accents, but he's just lovely. He's a wonderful writer. He's written a number of books. I read one of his others, and they are just so pleasant.
Now, I wonder what Aileen and Honeybear have been up to this month. Let's find out in Aileen's Letter from a Dog Walker.
Dear listener, there is a definite nip in the air when Honey and I take our stroll in the evening, which I suppose is not surprising because autumn is starting to change our surroundings. Yesterday we left home at about 6:30 in the evening and walked down through Mules Park and along the seafront where we dodged the white spray thrown high up against the sea wall by the high tide. The sea looked very full. At the end of the promenade, from the car park, we looked towards Dartmoor, where the setting sun was magically turning everything an intense gold tinged with red. Honey never fails to amaze me. She has an excellent memory, seeking out within the house and the garden her orange spiky ball from where it was last used. It is never in the same place, but she seldom fails to find it. In the morning she brings it upstairs to drop it on the bed as a gift for me. It is really a hint that I should get up and play with her. Yesterday we awakened to a beautiful day. The sky was cloudless and Mediterranean blue, and as the day advanced, the air warmed. A perfect day for a visit to Dawlish Countryside Park. Just in case there was a sudden change in the weather, I had a Pacamac in my backpack, along with the usual bottle of water and blue collapsible dog bowl, treats and dog bags, and some menthol sweets just for me. Although there had been rain on the previous day, the sandy ground under the grass was surprisingly dry. Honey, off her lead, was enjoying the freedom of unrestricted space. I set a leisurely pace, aiming to walk the 1.5 mile path encircling the inside of the park. The first part of the route has a gradual rise, but then the path becomes quite steep as you head for the top, which is the boundary where the park adjoins, but does not include, Easton Woods. Honey was, as usual, head down, tail wagging in the air, intently following invisible scent trails, but always ready to meet and chase friendly dogs along the way. Descending towards us, a black Labrador stepped to chase and be chased, until a loud whistle from his walker ended their play. Because of the lovely sunshine, I was taking it easy and was passed by a dachshund whose little short legs were working hard to keep up with his walker, who seemed to be out for a run and not a walk. On the ridge, the view is really worthwhile. Just where it is needed, there is a long, rustic bench, beside which is a splendid large carving of an owl and an observation map indicating places of interest on the skyline. These include Berry Head and Haldon Forest. Sitting on the bench, I watched Honey follow a bright red butterfly, which eventually flew away. Resuming our walk, we saw no one until we arrived once more on relatively level ground, where we met Sarah, our dogminder, out with several dogs in tow, including Ollie, whose company Honey greatly enjoys. Back in the car park, pleased to have completed the full tour, Honey and I had a cool drink of water before driving home. The evening of the same day, I left Honey to look after the house, and I drove to the Pavilions, Tynmouth, to see a film. Showing 28 of the remaining 37 paintings known to exist by 17th century master Johannes Vermeer. These were on display from February to June 2023 at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam for the largest retrospective exhibition of Vermeer paintings ever seen. Probably the best known painting is entitled The Girl with a Pearl Earring, and you may know The Little Street and The Lacemaker. The magic of Vermeer's artistry is that his paintings are like photographs, without visible brushstrokes, capturing perfectly the architecture, fashion, and people of his time. Vermeer lived in Holland between 1632 and 1675, and to put this in context, in the United Kingdom, King Charles I was beheaded in 1649, and Oliver Cromwell became Lord Protector in 1653. Like the pharaohs of Egypt, Vermeer has found a form of immortality. Time to feed Honey. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
Miss Fran Frank with a very interesting article about plastic houses.
Hello. The following article appeared in a recent copy of the iPaper, and it's about a couple of young design students in India who are obviously very concerned about their environment. The article is entitled 16,000 Bottles of Cheer. When a pair of young friends found themselves stuck at home during the pandemic, they came up with a plan to build an eco-friendly home using thousands of plastic bottles. Both now 23, the classmates were studying fine arts in Western India and had been looking for a location where they could open a themed cafe in their hometown. The nationwide pandemic lockdown during 2020 dashed their hopes. Instead, they began researching the issue of pollution and ended up constructing a set of buildings from 16,000 non-recyclable plastic bottles. The graduates from the Government College of Art and Design realised that plastic was a severe menace in their city and decided to do something about it. They discovered that it was possible to build structures using eco bricks made from plastic bottles and soil. We started collecting empty plastic bottles from our city whenever there was a relaxation in the restrictions. Not everyone was convinced. Our parents didn't take us seriously and felt we might quit. Even our neighbours laughed and ridiculed us, but we were determined. It took them almost a year to complete the research and to collect 16,000 bottles. Construction began in March 2022 and was completed the following August. The eco bricks were placed on top of each other and the wall was plastered with a mixture of soil and cow dung. The roof and doors were built using bamboo and wood. But the process was not smooth, as the workers had never heard about any such eco-friendly house and left after a few days. It took a lot of persuasion to bring them back. The pair eventually managed to build six huts, comprising of square-shaped rooms that were partially open and two round huts. The buildings were leased to a restaurant owner. The friends went on to build another similar house at a farm in their hometown using 2,500 plastic bottles. They say that the buildings are not only environmentally friendly, but also cheaper than the traditional alternative. The cost of a cement one-room house is around £953, but our houses can be made for £667. They do not demand high maintenance and just have to be polished with cow dung or wet soil every so often. The houses are much cooler. The soil, unfortunately, has a danger of being washed away during severe rain, but they are fine during normal showers, and they're expected to last for about 10 years. Did you know that 1 million plastic bottles of water are sold every minute globally, a figure that is expected to nearly double by 2030?
Not a bad idea about plastic houses. They could be sustainable, and following rigorous testing, the answer to the shortage of affordable living. What do you think, Valerie?
I'd be afraid to live in a house like that, because it might melt.
Let's listen to John Townsend about why he doesn't like Halloween.
On the whole, we do our best to be kind to children and animals on roundabout. But I'm about to change all that. Forgive me, but Halloween this month always tends to make me slightly cruel to both. I try not to, but I just can't help it. Allow me to explain, as well as convince you, that no cat or child was harmed in what is about to follow. As soon as all that Halloween paraphernalia appears in the shops, I get a bit tetchy. I guess most of us either try to ignore all the fuss, or see Halloween as a great opportunity for parties, dressing up, and watching scary films. For some it's just harmless fun, for others it's tacky nonsense, nasty, or just another American import to be avoided. Yes, strictly speaking, of course, the United States just took over an ancient festival and simply repackaged it with all the trimmings. Apparently, all this spooky stuff goes back over 2,000 years. It all started as a pre-Christian Celtic festival called Samhain, which means summer's end. Held in the beginning of November, the feast recognised the last day of autumn harvest and spirits crossing over, since they believed the veil between the living and spirit world grew thinnest at that time. People in Ireland, the United Kingdom and Northern France used to ward off ghosts by lighting sacrificial bonfires and, yes, you've guessed it, wearing costumes to trick the spirits. Now, according to my research, all this trick-or-treating has been around since medieval times. Taking sweets from strangers on one night a year isn't a new or American tradition. It was known as guising in Scotland and Ireland. Young people dressed up in costumes and went door to door looking for food or money in exchange for performing songs, poems or other tricks. Today the tradition has morphed into children dressing up, asking for sweets and doing something silly if they don't get them. Well, that's asking for trouble if you ask me. Apart from Christmas, Halloween is the biggest money-making event of the year. Despite the COVID years throwing a wet blanket over trick-or-treaters, Americans are back to spending something like $9 billion on Halloween. It's estimated to be about £680 million in the UK and almost £30 million spent by Brits on pumpkins alone each year. Even though not a penny of that is from me, bah humbug, I was tempted a few years ago when passing a shop window in Tynmouth. It had an impressive Halloween display, and there in the middle of it all was a hideous, life-sized black cat with scary eyes, wiry whiskers and snarling teeth. I entered the shop and asked how much it was. Oh, no, that ain't for sale, sir. Display only. Ah, but what if I'd like to buy it? Well, no, I 20 quid. Goodness knows what I look like carrying the realistically scary beast all the way home, tucked under my arm. But you see, I had a use for it. All my other attempts to protect my vegetable patch over the winter had failed. Now, don't get me wrong, I've always liked cats. I've owned a few myself in my time, but for some reason, all the cats in the neighbourhood regard my veg patch as a communal litter tray. But now I had not so much a scarecrow as a scaredy cat. I plonked it slap bang in the middle of the brassicas and watched. Sure enough, next door's tabby hopped onto the raised bed, was about to squat, but caught a glimpse of my new chum and, like a Tom and Jerry electric shock, made an instant bolt for the hedge. Success! My Halloween cat had triumphed. Needless to say, the novelty soon wore off, and all cats were soon rubbing noses with it affectionately and back to their wicked ways. So now, having upset all cat lovers, let me now put fear into children as I release my inner Mr. Clark. I may have read my cautionary verse for children a few years ago, but I make no apology for sharing it again here, as it may just amuse any fellow Halloween phobics experiencing Samhainophobia. It's called Ghostly Warnings. The night that troubled Mr. Clark was Halloween, just after dark, when children spot on 4:30 came trick-or-treating at his door. He couldn't bear to hear the knock, those squeals and woos by 5 o'clock. The cheeky taunts to make him scared produced a smirk. He was prepared. Flicking wide his letterbox, he fired out sopping smelly socks. "No treats are here," he crossly mocked, as some poor child got duly socked. The next he squirted jets of slime, while shouting, "Clear off!" all the time. "I'll give you tricks," he hissed, then chose his high-speed max-strength pressure hose. "You might be young and very little, but I'll knock you over like a skittle." Water sprayed and stung their legs, as next he pelted them with eggs. Flower bombs flew, he got a strike and knocked a werewolf off her bike. Then next a stink bomb landed, splat, on a witch's broom and cat. "You'll not scare me," he squealed and flung a steaming splodge of farmyard dung. The ghostly sheets, now smudged with stains, were blasted next with sludge from drains, to frantic yelling, screams and bleats, as frenzied ghosts ripped off their sheets. "Leave me in peace is all I ask," he splattered paint at every mask, purples, reds and yucky greens. "How I hate these Halloweens! This'll stop your ghoulish pranks." He paused, but somewhere in the ranks someone sniggered, and he snapped. "Right, that's it. You'll all be zapped." His hand reached up to flick the switch to decimate each ghost and witch. A trapdoor opened in the wall, from which shot out a cannonball. Across the road at 68, the blast destroyed the whole front gate before demolishing the door, plus 66 and 64. From his trapdoor gurgles blurted, boiling, bubbling blubber spurted, followed by a sludgy paste of luminous atomic waste. As if that wasn't quite enough, Mr. Clark got rather tough and turned a tap beside the door, which hissed as smoke rose from the floor. Beside the doorstep, where, alas, there hung a cloud of mustard gas. Liquid sprayed from every side, just a rinse of cyanide. He sniggered, fiendishly inspired, as next a hail of missiles fired. Fuses smoking all alight, detonating dynamite. And as he screamed, "No scarper off!" he reached for his Kalashnikov. "I'll give you trick or treat," he barked, as the cat flap smoked and sparked. Instead of treats like lemonades, he hurled out fizzing hand grenades. And just to make the children certain, he drew right back the front door curtain to reveal a shining dome. "This might make you clear off home, and don't come back, that's my advice." He launched his nuclear device, which cleared his front doorstep a treat, as well as wiping out the street. So when the smoke cleared very late, there was no sign of the estate. No trick-or-treaters could be seen. Such a peaceful Halloween. Children, if you now feel too much fear to trick-or-treat another year, remember that you must beware, as Mr. Clark is still out there, waiting just behind his wall for ghouls and ghosts in sheets to call. So if these fears give sleepless nights, and if you dread such scary frights, advice from Mr. Clark is this: try giving Halloween a miss. Instead, take heed, reflect, and pause. It might be best to stay indoors.
Our final piece of music is the song "The Gas Man Cometh" by Flanders and Swann. It is 60 years since the opening of their musical review, At the Drop of Another Hat.
"'Twas on a Monday morning, the gas man came to call. The gas tap wouldn't turn, I wasn't getting gas at all. He tore out all the skirting boards to try and find the main, and I had to call a carpenter to put them back again. Oh, it all makes work for the working man to do. On the Tuesday morning, the carpenter came round. He hammered and he chiseled and he said,
look what I found. Your joists are full of dry rot, but I'll put them all to rights.
Then he nailed right through a cable, and out went all the lights. Makes work for the working man to do.
"'Twas on a Wednesday morning, the electrician came. He called me Mr. Sanderson, which isn't quite my name. He couldn't reach the fuse box without standing on the bin.
And his foot went through a window, so I called the glazier in. Though it all makes work for the working man to do. 'Twas on the Thursday morning, the glazier came along with his blowtorch and his putty and his merry glazier song. He put another pane in, it took no time at all,
but I had to get a painter in to come and paint the wall. Oh, it all makes work for the working man to do. 'Twas on a Friday morning, the painter made a start
with undercoats
and overcoats.
He painted every part, every nook and every cranny, but I found when he was gone, he painted over the gas tap and I couldn't turn it on. Oh, for the working man to do. On Saturday and Sunday, they do no work at all. So it was on the Monday morning that the gas man came to call.
We have come to the end of this month's Roundabout programme. If you would like to send us your feedback on this programme, or request a piece of music of your choice to be played, or share some interesting information, we'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch by sending a note in the memory stick wallet, or by phone or text to 07 376 147 374. I repeat, 07 376 147 374.
Our thanks go to Jenny Jenkins and her guest, Stacey Gilbert, Norma Orty, Stephen Taylor, and Mary MacDonald,
Valerie Forrester, Aileen Clarkson, Fran Frank, and John Townsend.
Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the program to our website. The program was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.
From Valerie and I,
goodbye.